Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we cut through the noise and give you the essential knowledge you need to navigate the cutting edge of science and society. I'm Tommy Margerson, your guide, and I'm honestly buzzing about the incredible stack of sources we've pulled together this week.
And I'm Max Reason, here to provide the crucial context, connect the dots, and ensure that for you, the curious learner, we understand not just the fact of a discovery, but why it fundamentally matters to the future.
We absolutely do. Today, we are undertaking a meticulous deep dive into the insights, discoveries, and controversies reported in the New Scientist magazine for the week of November 29th, 2025.
That's right. Our mission is to take you on a comprehensive journey through this single issue. We're extracting core knowledge from, well, radical physics breakthroughs that completely challenge our perception of what reality even is.
Right.
All the way to the grim political realities of global climate negotiations and revolutionary new technologies mapping human disease cell by cell. We will ensure nothing critical is missed.
And speaking of mind-bending physics, our opening hook comes straight from the cover story. It's a truly radical proposal.
It really is.
It suggests a whole new way to look at reality, proposing that everything we perceive might emerge from fundamental quantum cause and effect. It's suggesting causality isn't just a pattern we observe. It's the building block of the universe.
Indeed. It's a stunning idea that might just simplify the search for quantum gravity. But before we break down the fabric of existence, we need to address perhaps the most pressing reality facing our world.
One which is unfortunately marked by political stagnation on a global scale.
Exactly. Let's start with the climate.
Let's start with the recent climate summit, COP30, which just wrapped up in Belém, Brazil. The atmosphere sounds like it was, well, chaotic even before they started negotiating.
Chaotic is an understatement. The headline outcome was little agreement, and the summit itself was literally plagued by external events.
You mean the rain and protests?
Torrential rain, massive protests outside, and even an electrical fire inside the venue that caused a temporary shutdown. This chaos surrounding the negotiation really mirrored the chaos inherent in the process itself.
And the final document they eventually agreed on, it was called the Global Mutaround. I found that choice of name fascinating, given the outcome.
It's deeply ironic. Mutaround is an indigenous Brazilian word that refers to a collective effort, you know, a tradition where a community comes together to accomplish a shared goal, like harvesting a field.
Right, a joint effort.
But while the document did reaffirm the commitment to the Paris Agreement, which is a small victory, I suppose,
It
utterly failed to achieve the kind of successful collective labor that the name implies.
And the main reason for that failure, the core fossil fuel standoff, was the most glaring problem. Over 80 nations, many of them small island states, were desperately calling for a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels.
That's language that was successfully used in COP28 the year before.
Exactly. But here, the final text was entirely scrubbed clean, not a mention.
And this is where the failure of the process becomes so starkly visible. The outcome was the direct result of petrostates, led prominently by former COP host Saudi Arabia blocking consensus.
And because COP requires unanimity, any single nation can just veto everything.
That's the problem. It requires all 194 states to agree. So any strong coalition can effectively veto meaningful action. Colombia's delegate, Diana Mejia, was quoted as saying that a consensus imposed under climate denialism is a failed agreement.
The New Scientist leader commentary was brutal in its assessment of this. They used an analogy that really cuts to the quick.
I saw that, the one about the doctor.
Yes. Treating climate change like a life-threatening disease with a clear prognosis, but the doctor refuses to even mention the diagnosis.
So the process addresses the symptoms, the extreme weather, the rising heat, but it refuses to name the cause, burning fossil fuels.
Which leads directly to the analysis that the COP process itself is simply no longer fit for purpose.
And that's a crucial insight, isn't it? If the primary global mechanism for managing an existential threat requires 100% agreement, and the people who benefit most from the threat's cause have a veto,
the process can't succeed.
It just can't. And this failure is happening while the climate action tracker shows we are currently tracking toward 2.6 degrees Celsius of warming. We're blowing past the 1.5 degree goal.
I have to push back a little on the idea that the process is entirely useless, though. Didn't the fact that the main text stressed unity behind the Paris Agreement and the IPCC findings? Didn't that act as a pushback against those trying to undermine things?
That's a fair point.
Especially considering the heavy blows multilateralism took this year.
And the political context was indeed hostile.
Yeah.
We saw Donald Trump pull the U.S., the world's second largest emitter, out of the COP process again. Argentina also threatened to leave.
Right.
So when Washington is also torpedoing talks on shipping emissions and plastic pollution at other global forums, the fact that the Paris framework held together, that sends a powerful, defiant signal to investors, to businesses, that the global goal remains fixed.
So it's valuable even if the actionable steps are missing.
I think so, yes. But the fundamental issue remains stagnation. Michael LePage highlighted that for 4 years, there has been little to no measurable progress.
Renewable energy is growing fast, yes, but it's completely offset by massive continuing investment in fossil fuels globally.
And LePage's analysis of the irrationality of this situation is perhaps the most chilling part of the entire report. He argues that instead of ramping up action as the impacts get worse, our collective response is becoming more irrational.
Fear and cognitive overload.
Exactly. It causes people and governments to abandon long-term rational planning in favor of immediate, visible fixes.
So we see governments prioritizing the cost of living crisis, which is politically an immediate win, over the climate crisis, which is a decades-long struggle.
Precisely. But this is where the logic just breaks down. LePage stresses the inherent irrationality here. The cost of living crisis is, in part, a climate crisis.
Because extreme weather drives up food prices.
Droughts, floods, they're destroying crops, disrupting supply chains, driving up food prices globally. By delaying climate action, governments are exacerbating the very cost of living issues they claim to be prioritizing. It's a political feedback loop that guarantees worse outcomes.
Before we transition, let's note the few actionable items on finance and forestry. They did agree to develop a just transition mechanism, which is intended to help lower-income countries adapt.
And they pledged to triple adaptation finance, which is desperately needed. However, and this is crucial, they delayed the deadline for that from 2030 to 2035.
5 extra years.
Which led to immediate, sharp criticism that for the most vulnerable nations, there is still nothing tangible to celebrate. A promise 5 years further down the road doesn't solve today's problems.
One truly positive leadership step, though, was taken by the host nation, Brazil.
Right, on deforestation. They launched the Tropical Forests Forever Facility.
What's that exactly?
It's an investment fund. It's designed to pay countries to leave their forests standing, moving away from some of the more problematic carbon offsetting schemes.
And it's working.
Well, they're still short of their $25 billion goal, but they've committed $6.6 billion so far. That's a significant and welcome step. Experts praise this move by Brazil to assume international leadership on deforestation,
which, given the Amazon's importance, is a critical outcome of having the summit in Belém.
Absolutely.
So while the global process remains mired in the concrete reality of political gridlock, some physicists are daring to redefine reality itself. Let's shift now from the pressing issues of carbon budgets to the fundamental budget of existence.
The cover story, The Quantum Leap, tackles one of the biggest philosophical headaches in modern physics, the measurement problem or the observer problem.
This is the issue where quantum mechanics, despite its phenomenal success at predicting outcomes, is widely described as a theory that predicts very well and explains very badly. What exactly is the core paradox here?
Well, the paradox arises from the conflict between how quantum systems behave when they're left alone versus when they're measured. When it's unobserved, a system like an electron exists in what we call a superposition, a fog of possible alternatives, mathematically described by the Schrödinger equation.
So it's in many places at once.
Exactly. But the moment an observer measures it, the system instantaneously collapses into a single definite state.
And the issue is that physicists don't have a clear, non-arbitrary definition of what an observer even is. Is it a person, a camera, a particle detector?
Right. And if reality only becomes fixed upon observation, how can we possibly apply quantum theory to the vast majority of the universe that evolved before any observers existed? It's completely unsatisfying.
So in come Nick Ormerod and Jonathan Barrett from UCL with their radical new interpretation.
One that completely sidesteps the need for external observers by elevating causality to the fundamental level of reality. This interpretation is built on two existing yet incomplete ideas.
Okay, what are they?
The first is the consistent histories interpretation, which tries to look at all possible sequences of properties a system could have over time and assign probabilities to them.
But it doesn't decide which history is the real one.
No. And the second is relational quantum mechanics, which says properties are relative. A system only gets definite properties at the moment it interacts with another system. Reality is defined by that relationship. But it lacked a rigorous mathematical foundation.
So Ormerod and Barrett merge these ideas, and their central concept is causal bubbles.
That's right. They argue that quantum systems are fundamentally a network of these causal bubbles, and the structure of that network, how subsystems within a bubble influence one another, is what determines the evolution of the properties we perceive.
That sounds tricky. Is there an analogy for that?
They use a brilliant one, a spider's web. We usually think the web is made of points, where the particles are connected by threads.
Okay.
In this new view, the threads representing causation are fundamental.
Mm.
The points, which are the definite properties of the particles, only emerge where the threads interact. They are secondary.
So the universe starts with the rules of influence, and everything else emerges from that.
That's the idea. The cause and effect comes first.
So how does this causal bubble framework resolve the observer paradoxes? I mean, specifically, the famous Wigner's friend paradox.
Right. So in the Wigner's friend paradox, you have Wigner watching his friend in a lab measuring a quantum system.
Yeah.
Wigner's friend sees a definite result, say the electron is here. But because Wigner's outside the lab, standard quantum mechanics says Wigner sees the entire lab friend apparatus and electron still in a superposition.
So for Wigner, the electron is still potentially here or there.
Exactly. When Wigner opens the door and looks, then the whole system collapses. This implies that Wigner and his friend have contradictory experiences of reality, which suggests no objective reality exists.
That's truly baffling. How did the causal bubbles fix this?
They introduce the concept of relational definiteness. Wigner and his friend are embedded in different causal bubbles. The friend is in a small bubble where the measurement happens, making the electron definite relative to the friend.
But Wigner is in a bigger bubble.
A much larger bubble that encompasses the whole lab. So relative to him, the state remains indefinite until he interacts with the whole system. The key is that both perspectives are valid relative to their own causal structure. You don't need to privilege one observer over the other.
That completely alters the landscape. If properties are just relational facts tied to causal structure, that's where it connects to the holy grail of unification, right?
Exactly. This is the tantalizing suggestion. In general relativity, decades ago, physicists showed that if you know the causal structure of space-time, which points influence with others, you can mathematically reconstruct its geometry.
Space-time geometry emerges from causality.
It does. So space-time geometry emerges from causality on one side for relativity, and quantum particle properties emerge from causality on the other side for quantum mechanics.
Then causality could be the single common root for both.
It's a beautiful simplification. Instead of relying on complex, unproven concepts like extra dimensions or string theory to find quantum gravity, this suggests the answer might be in just reorganizing the foundational ingredient we already recognize, cause and effect.
Moving from the very foundations of reality to something as fundamental as light, we have news that physics established 180 years ago has just been rewritten.
And it involves Michael Faraday. In 1845, he discovered that magnetism alters light polarization. The Faraday effect. For centuries, we attributed this exclusively to the electric component of light interacting with charges in a material.
The magnetic part was just ignored.
For practical purposes, yes.
Yeah.
But the new findings by Amir Kapua and Benjamin Asselin show that the magnetic component of light plays a measurable and, well, significant role, especially with circularly polarized light.
And what is that exactly?
Circularly polarized light is light whose fields spiral forward like a corkscrew. They realized that this spiraling magnetic component interacts much more intensely with the quantum spin, the intrinsic angular momentum inside a magnetic material.
And this effect isn't negligible. Using a material called terbium gallium garnet, TGG, they found this magnetic interaction accounts for 17% of the Faraday effect with visible light.
But here's the kicker, the point where you absolutely have to rewrite the textbooks. When using infrared light instead of visible light, the magnetic interaction was responsible for up to 70% of the observed effect.
70%? Wow.
It completely overturns the established theory.
So the future impact here is in spintronics, isn't it?
Precisely. Spintronics is an emerging field that seeks to use the quantum spin of electrons, not their charge, to store and process information. This new finding gives us a new, highly efficient way to manipulate those spins using light's magnetic component,
paving the way for faster, smaller, more energy-efficient devices.
That's it all.
Finally, let's look at a practical breakthrough in computing reliability, the recycling of qubits.
Quantum computers are notoriously fragile and error-prone. The slightest disturbance can cause a computation to fail. So to get reliable results, you need robust error correction. And that requires vast numbers of specialized Ancilla qubits dedicated just to tracking errors.
And building enough of those is a huge challenge. So Matt Norcia's team at Atom Computing focused on Ancilla reuse. They use qubits made from extremely cold erbium atoms and organize their computer into three distinct zones.
The three zones are critical. First, you have the computation zone, where the actual calculation happens. Second, the error measurement and swapping zone, where the Ancillas check for errors. And third, the storage zone.
Why is that storage zone so important?
Because once an Ancilla qubit has been used, its own quantum state is scrambled. It's not pristine anymore. So it can't simply be reused immediately. In the storage zone, they apply precise techniques, laser cooling, magnetic pulses, to reset the qubit to a fresh quantum state.
And the breakthrough was showing they could successfully reset and reuse the same Ancilla qubits 41 times in a row without introducing new errors.
41 times. That's the defining factor here. Without Ancilla reuse, experts estimate that even modest calculations would require millions, maybe billions, of fresh qubits. This recycling technique is fundamentally necessary for any practical progress.
From the microscopic world of quantum bits, we now move to the microscopic world of human tissue, where technology is letting us map diseases in such intricate detail that we're finding treatments for things previously deemed untreatable.
This brings us to the feature on the radical body map, specifically focusing on toxic epidermal necrolysis, or TEN. This is a terrifying, life-threatening drug reaction.
Catastrophic, really. It destroys the entire outer layer of the skin, leaving the patient vulnerable to infection and dehydration. The historical mortality rate was about 30%.
And the reason it was so deadly was that doctors just didn't understand the underlying biological mechanism driving the destruction.
The fundamental roadblock has always been single-cell variation, right? Traditional medical tests analyze a bulk sample of tissue. As the article puts it, they mash together hundreds of cells, creating a biological smoothie.
And the subtle, crucial difference between a sick cell and a seemingly healthy neighboring cell is just lost in that mush.
So to bypass this, researchers are now deploying spatial multiomics technologies. This is a suite of tools that combine high-resolution imaging with deep analysis of the cell's genomics, transcriptomics, and proteomics.
They don't just ask what molecules are present, but precisely where they are and how they are interacting in their physical context.
One incredible example of this is deep visual proteomics, developed by Andreas Mund. He's detailed a four-stage process that sounds almost like science fiction.
It is precision engineering applied to biology. First, they slice and stain the tissue. Second, they use advanced AI to map the tissue and flag abnormal cells. Third, a laser dissection tool cuts out and tracks specific single cells.
And finally, those cells are analyzed by incredibly sensitive mass spectrometry.
Mund describes the sensitivity as being able to detect differences equivalent to weighing a jumbo jet versus a jumbo jet with a fly on it.
Wow. And they've already used this to reveal crucial secrets in pancreatic cancer.
Yes. By analyzing thousands of proteins, they made a shocking discovery. Even cells that appeared entirely normal under a microscope, but were near a tumor, showed early molecular signs of trouble inflammation and stress markers.
Meaning this could potentially reveal very early biomarkers for one of the deadliest cancers long before a tumor is even detectable.
That's the hope. And there's a parallel tool, spatial transcriptomics, which tracks the RNA inside individual cells.
And since RNA is the blueprint for proteins, mapping the transcriptome gives you a snapshot of what the cell is actively doing.
This was key in ovarian cancer research. They focused on fibroblast cells that usually protect the tumor. By mapping their transcriptome, they discovered these fibroblasts were responding strongly to an enzyme called NNMT.
And when NNMT was active,
the fibroblasts released chemicals that essentially shielded the cancer by dampening the body's immune response.
Which led to a direct treatment path.
Absolutely. Knowing the exact mechanism, they developed an NNMT inhibitor. In mouse trials, this drug stopped the fibroblasts from creating that immune shield, allowing the body's own immune system to attack and shrink the tumor effectively.
And this brings us back to TEN, the breakthrough that spatial proteomics delivered for that condition. A dermatologist, Thierry Nordman, using this technology on patient samples, found a striking pattern.
He discovered a massive misplaced overactivity of the interferon pathway. This pathway is the body's normal defense, usually triggered by a virus.
Right, to activate antiviral defenses.
But in 10 patients, the drug reaction mistakenly activated this powerful pathway, causing the immune system to initiate a massive, catastrophic destruction of the outer skin layer, mistaking healthy cells for infected ones.
Which led immediately to the treatment breakthrough.
They targeted the JAK-STAT signaling pathway, which was driving this misplaced response, using existing drugs already approved for conditions like rheumatoid arthritis.
And the human trial results.
Astounding. 7 patients were treated, all survived. One man, who had lost 35% of his outer skin, grew back almost all of it in just 16 days.
16 days? That's incredible.
Nordman is confident this will become the standard 10 treatment within 2 to 3 years. The potential to transform an incurable condition into a manageable one is profound. And the implications stretch far beyond just skin.
Right, they're using it for heart disease and diabetes now, too.
Exactly. It's ushering in a new age of precision medicine by giving us the full 3D molecular context of disease.
Let's shift our focus to some other critical health news, starting with gut health and ulcerative colitis, a major form of inflammatory bowel disease.
Researchers have identified a strong link between this debilitating condition and a specific bacterial toxin arylicin produced by certain strains of Aeromonas bacteria. They're often called MTB, or macrophage toxic bacteria.
And the mechanism is quite destructive.
It is. This arylicin toxin specifically targets and kills resident macrophage immune cells, which form a crucial protective layer in the colon lining. The death of these cells compromises the lining, which then triggers the severe inflammation of colitis.
The correlation they found was striking. 72% of people with ulcerative colitis in the study had Aeromonas bacteria compared to only 12% of people without it.
While that's a strong correlation, we have to retain the nuance. MTB isn't the sole cause. Genetic predispositions, environmental factors, they're all still vital components. You can have MTB without developing colitis.
But the finding is actionable. It suggests 3 new treatment paths.
Very specific paths. Developing drugs to neutralize the toxin itself. Creating vaccines that target either the toxin or the bacteria, or, perhaps most intriguingly, using phage therapy.
Viruses engineered to kill only the problem bacteria.
Exactly.
Next, a fascinating and somewhat counterintuitive finding about the loss of the Y chromosome in men and its impact on lung cancer outcomes. We know that as men age, some cells naturally shed the Y chromosome.
The new research focused on lung adenocarcinoma, the most common type. They discovered that cancerous cells frequently lacked Y chromosomes, and this was true regardless of smoking history. As the tumor grew, the proportion of Y-less cells increased.
And the negative consequence is clear. The loss of the Y chromosome leads to reduced expression of antigens.
The molecular flags that normally signal T cells that a cancer cell is abnormal and must be destroyed.
So by dropping these signals, the Y-less cancer cells can evade immune surveillance and proliferate faster.
Right. But here's the unexpected twist. The loss of the Y chromosome was associated with a better treatment outcome when patients were given immune checkpoint inhibitors like pembrolizumab.
So while it helps the cancer grow initially, it makes it more vulnerable to the specific immunotherapy.
That's what it suggests. These drugs essentially take the brakes off the body's T cells, letting them attack. It's an exciting finding that mirrors previous observations in bladder cancer.
Finally, a potentially massive shift in treatment for obesity and type 2 diabetes. A daily pill that could replace weekly injections like Ozempic or Wegovy.
This is orforglipron from Eli Lilly. It's an oral drug that mimics the GLP-1 hormone, which regulates appetite and insulin release. Convenience is the obvious draw here.
A daily pill is far easier than a weekly self-injection.
It is. The trial results showed good efficacy. The high-dose group lost nearly 10% of their average body weight over 72 weeks.
10% is less than the 15% you get with injections, but that convenience factor is immense.
Immense. But we have to look at the trade-off. About 10% of participants on the high dose were forced to stop taking the drug due to severe side effects, mainly nausea and diarrhea.
A significant dropout rate. So it's not a universal replacement, but another option?
Exactly. It's likely better suited for a different subset of patients who prioritize convenience but have the necessary tolerance for the side effects.
Let's talk about a true ecological hero in disguise, the hoverfly. These insects are often completely overlooked compared to the charismatic bee, but their value is immense.
They're described as harmless mimics. They look like wasps or bees to deter predators, but they are in fact critical pollinators. The article cites that hoverflies pollinate a staggering 72% of all food crops.
A service estimated to be worth $300 billion annually.
And they possess several key advantages over managed honeybees. Unlike bees, they're not deterred by bad weather. They keep working when it's cool or cloudy, making them reliable.
So they're more dependable on some crops.
On some specific crops, like carrots and strawberries, they're shown to outperform bees in pollination success. And their utility is dual purpose. Not only do they pollinate, but their larvae are incredibly effective pest controllers.
A single larva can devour up to 400 aphids.
Exactly. One species, Eupioides coralei, can wipe out 62% of aphids on strawberry crops. It's a natural, built-in, mobile pest control and pollination service.
And the scale of their migration is truly astonishing. Up to 4 billion hoverflies migrate over southern England yearly,
carrying over 7 times the combined mass of all migrating birds.
Yep.
And their migration serves a vital ecological function, dispersing pollen over vast distances, which is crucial for linking isolated plant populations.
Researchers found one hoverfly 200 kilometers offshore carrying pollen from 8 different plant species.
This massive movement helps spread genes that might be favorable for resistance to disease or drought, effectively helping fight climate change impacts by strengthening plant populations.
Unfortunately, their numbers are declining significantly in some areas faster than bees. The UK has seen a 24% drop, Germany a frightening 80% decrease.
And the threats are multi-layered. Intensive agriculture and pesticide use are major culprits. But also, paradoxically, high-density managed honeybees can compete for local nectar, leaving little for wild pollinators.
And the most critical habitat threat relates to their life cycle. Hoverfly larvae need decaying organic matter. Rotting wood, compost heaps, stagnant ponds.
And modern, tidy agricultural practices often eliminate those environments. We are removing their nursery.
But solutions are emerging. Commercial breeding operations, like Polyfly in Spain, can produce billions of pollinators per year. And researchers are also training them to respond to specific flower scents,
which could make them precision pollinators for specific crops. But ultimately, habitat protection restoring ponds, leaving rotting logs, is the essential step for preserving this crucial hidden hero.
That was a compelling case for ecological diversification. Let's pivot to some evolutionary puzzles, starting with something fundamental. The very beginning of reproductive life sperm.
It turns out the sperm toolkit, the set of about 300 gene families necessary for sperm function, is incredibly ancient. Researchers traced it back over 700 million years to a single-celled ancestor of all living animals.
So sperm didn't need to be invented from scratch when animals evolved multicellularity.
Exactly. It suggests sperm is essentially a repurposed unicellular body plan. Our distant ancestors were single cells swimming in the ocean using a tail to move. When multicellular life evolved, they just adapted that existing swimming machinery for reproduction.
What's fascinating is the differential rate of evolution. The head of the sperm, with the DNA, has diversified wildly, but the tail, the motor, has remained highly conserved.
The basic propulsion system is 700 million years old.
Next, let's tackle the loaded question. How old is kissing?
The researchers first had to define kissing very strictly. They defined it as non-antagonistic mouth-to-mouth contact involving lip movement but not transferring food. Then they applied statistical modeling across primate family trees.
And their conclusion?
It suggests kissing likely evolved in ancestral apes between 21.5 and 16.9 million years ago. And they calculated an 84% chance that Neanderthals also kissed.
Why did it evolve?
Two leading hypotheses. One is reproductive, promoting arousal or assessing mate quality, you know, quick check of breath as a health indicator. The other is strengthening social bonding, mitigating tension, the kiss and makeup behavior we see in chimps.
Speaking of Neanderthals, a new analysis of the Altamura man challenges a long-held assumption about their anatomy.
Right. For years, the hefty, large noses of Neanderthals were thought to be an adaptation to cold glacial conditions for warming and humidifying air. But researchers used an endoscope and digital reconstruction to look inside the skull and found evidence against this.
What was the crucial finding?
It was the structure of the nasal cavity. They found specific features previously considered defining of Neanderthal cold adaptation were entirely absent in this well-preserved specimen.
So while they did have large turbinates to help warm air, the overall structure was likely not primarily shaped by adaptation to cold.
Exactly. It suggests the variation among Neanderthals was greater than we thought.
And finally, two great animal behavior anecdotes. First, the incredible observation of mouse midwives.
This is the first official documentation of assisted birth in non-primates. They studied pregnant female mice genetically engineered to lack oxytocin receptors, so they couldn't generate contractions.
And when a female who had previously given birth a midwife was present, 9 out of 10 pregnant mice survived.
The midwives used their mouth and paws to gently pull the pup out and critically immediately broke the fluid-filled sac, allowing it to breathe.
In contrast, when non-mother females or males tried to help, they often failed to break the sac,
which led to a much lower survival rate. The conclusion: successful midwifery is not just instinct, it's a learned social skill that requires prior mothering experience.
And the second anecdote, the ancient sea turtle stampede.
Imagine a rock face in Italy, etched with over 1,000 paddle prints from 83 million years ago in the Cretaceous period.
The sheer number suggests a massive simultaneous movement.
The hypothesis is that a powerful earthquake occurred, scaring the ancient sea turtles into a panic-driven evacuation towards the open sea. The prints were instantly preserved because the panic churned up soft sediment, which quickly buried and solidified the tracks.
A preserved record of mass aquatic panic.
Exactly.
Let's look up into space and discuss the search for population third stars, the primordial stars formed from the near-pristine elements created right after the Big Bang.
Current stellar models limit star mass to about 120 solar masses.
Yeah.
But theories suggest these population third stars could be absolutely huge, maybe 1,000 to 10,000 times the mass of the sun. The challenge is they're almost impossible to detect directly.
So researchers used JWST observations of a distant galaxy called GS3073 and found something unexpected.
Unusually high amounts of nitrogen in its chemical signatures. Devesh Nandal's team calculated that this excess nitrogen could only be accounted for by the presence of a few supermassive population 3 stars in the galaxy's history. They're calling it the strongest evidence to date.
However, that finding presents a major contradiction.
It does. Population 3 stars, by definition, require a near-pristine environment. They shouldn't have formed in the presence of heavy elements. But GS3073 is chemically described as fairly mature.
So it has a good mix of heavy elements already. It's a mismatch.
A total mismatch. It suggests we need to revise either our theories about how these stars form or how fast early galaxies chemically evolve.
Next, a fascinating archaeological discovery that completely transforms our understanding of prehistoric life in Eurasia. The massive Bronze Age city of Semiarka in Kazakhstan.
Dating back 3,600 years, around 1600 BC, this was a 140-hectare settlement. This overturns the long-standing view that the Central Asian steppes were populated only by highly mobile nomadic communities. This was a complex, fixed urban center.
The complexity is staggering. It had massive earth defense banks, at least 20 large enclosed compounds, and a central monumental building for governance or rituals.
And it was a crucial regional power because it was a massive bronze hub. Analysis of crucibles and slag revealed evidence of large-scale, sophisticated production of copper and tin bronze.
And the tin source was traced to deposits 300 kilometers away in the Altai Mountains.
Which suggests Semiarka was strategically positioned on the Irtysh River, acting as a key center of exchange and coordination within the vast Eurasian metal networks.
Turning to environmental shifts, we have a surprising finding about the Arctic Ocean. It is warming rapidly from below, not just from the surface.
Researchers focused on the deep Eurasian basin, between 1,500 and 2,600 meters deep. They found this layer has warmed by 0.074 degrees Celsius since 1990.
Which represents the transfer of about 500 trillion megajoules of energy into the deep ocean.
And to put that in context, if that energy were transferred to the surface, it'd be enough to melt a third of the minimum sea ice extent recorded in the Arctic.
What's causing the heat to penetrate so deep?
The cause is linked to freshwater melt from the Greenland ice sheet. This melt has slowed down the sinking of very cold, dense, deep water near Greenland. This cold, sinking water usually acts as a counterflow, canceling out the warming from Atlantic water.
And with that cancellation slowed, the warm Atlantic water is just penetrating deeper.
And holding its heat longer, rapidly warming the deep Arctic.
Moving from deep water to density on land, we have radical revised estimates on global urbanization from new UN reports.
The figures are stunning. Using a standardized, clearer definition of urban areas, the UN now estimates that 81% of the world's population lives in urban settings. This is dramatically higher than the previous 2018 estimate of 55%.
And that 81% is split between 45% in cities and 36% in towns. It's projected to rise to 83% by 2050.
The regional drivers vary. In Asia, it's still migration. But in sub-Saharan Africa, urban growth is mostly driven by birth rates exceeding death rates within those areas.
And this massive shift presents a duality for health.
On one hand, urban centers usually offer better healthcare access. On the other, population density exposes people to higher levels of air pollution, noise, and critically extreme heat, which is linked to increased cardiovascular disease and heightened risks for conditions like Alzheimer's.
Let's run through some quick science bites, starting with a fantastic test of life's resilience. Moss spores survived space.
Researchers locked 20,000 spores of the Moss Physcomitrium patens outside the International Space Station for 283 days. The results were astounding.
How many survived?
Over 80% of the spores that were fully exposed to the harsh vacuum and radiation of space germinated successfully back on Earth. Their viability is attributed to the incredibly robust multiple layers of their spore walls.
Which strengthens the case for panspermia, that life can survive interstellar journeys.
It really does. Next, the bizarre-sounding technique they call 3D necroprinting.
This sounds odd.
It's actually a brilliant piece of bioengineering. Scientists were struggling to find nozzles fine enough for 3D printing microstructures. So they used a severed female Egyptian mosquito proboscis, the stiff, delicate mouth part, as an extremely fine nozzle.
And how precise was this natural tool?
It allowed them to print structures as thin as 20 micrometers, far thinner than standard man-made nozzles can achieve. It's a perfect example of turning to nature's precision engineering.
We also have the discovery of a new structure at the edge of the solar system, the inner Kuiper Belt kernel.
An algorithm searching orbital data identified a compact cluster of icy objects at 43 astronomical units. These objects have remarkably circular, undisturbed orbits, what they call orbital calmness.
Suggesting it's an ancient, pristine structure that's been undisturbed since the solar system formed.
Offering vital clues for its early evolution. And finally, an ancient artifact from 12,000 years ago, an animistic figurine.
A tiny Natufian clay sculpture found near the Sea of Galilee depicting a goose on a woman's back.
And researchers interpret this as more than just a drawing. It's likely an imagined animistic ritual, the representation of mating between an animal spirit and a human, a theme common in animistic belief systems.
Max, let's conclude our deep dive by looking at some critical thinking and cultural shifts discussed in the magazine. We start with a commentary piece on the high-stakes, ethically charged concept of memory manipulation.
The phrase itself certainly sounds dystopian, doesn't it? Implanted lies, erased histories. But the research goal, as argued in the commentary, is far gentler and therapeutic, reducing suffering.
Right. The aim is to weaken traumatic recollections or strengthen fading memories for Alzheimer's patients.
Or decouple cravings from triggers for people with addiction.
The commentary outlined three core principles. Memories are malleable, they're distributed across the brain, and they can be artificially etched into the brain. That third point is the one that raises the most alarm bells.
It certainly does. When they talk about artificially etching memories, they mean techniques like optogenetics, using light to control genetically modified neurons. But the therapeutic application is to use it to stabilize or strengthen existing positive memories.
And the immediate clinical application relies on exploiting the reconsolidation window. What is that?
It's the brief period, sometimes just minutes after a memory is recalled, when it becomes temporarily destabilized and susceptible to change before it's restored. Therapists can use this window to intervene.
So you could say, recall a traumatic memory, but associate it with a feeling of safety.
Exactly. Research showed that simply reactivating positive memories during distress reversed depression-like behaviors in mice for over a month. The goal is to make remembering a medicine for the mind.
Next, we have a fascinating column on the incredible creativity required for dark matter research. I mean, how do you study something you can't see or touch?
It pushes physicists to their creative limits. They rely heavily on mathematical tools like quantum field theory or QFT. But because the specific properties of dark matter elude us, QFT isn't enough.
So they use effective field theories, or EFTs.
It's a brilliant concept. EFTs are generalized, tunable mathematical equations. They let physicists build simplified models that predict how dark matter might interact with visible matter, without having to know every detail of the unseen physics. They make smart, constrained guesses.
And this framework is constantly evolving based on experimental shifts.
It is. Historically, experiments looked for dark matter hitting a massive nucleus. Now, the search is moving to looking for dark matter scattering off electrons and materials. This requires completely new EFT models, keeping the research moving forward.
Let's jump into the curated culture highlights. We'll start with the top science books of 2025. First up is Positive Tipping Points by Tim Lenton.
Lenton argues that tipping points, where a small change creates a massive shift, aren't just negative. They can be positive, accelerating beneficial change.
He focuses on the power of small groups, disruptive innovation, and personal agency, like adopting electric vehicles or eating less meat.
He points to the policy feedback loop from EV adoption. More people buy EVs, demand for charging infrastructure grows, government invests, prices lower, which accelerates adoption. It's a virtuous cycle. His core philosophy is that what seems politically impossible one day can quickly become inevitable.
We also have Hannah Ritchie's Clearing the Air, which offers data-led answers to debunk common environmental myths.
She addresses, for instance, the myth that wind farms kill too many birds. While they do kill some, her data shows the number is overwhelmingly dwarfed by the annual kill rate from cats, windows, cars, and pesticides.
So it refocuses action on high-impact areas rather than paralyzing us with low-impact worries.
Precisely. Then there's The Lost Girls of Autism by Gina Rippon, which addresses the significant underestimation of autism prevalence in women and girls.
Rippon shares the powerful story of a woman named Alice who only realized her own neurotype after her son was diagnosed.
And Alice describes watching her son navigate the world and realizing that his ease of belonging showed her what not being autistic meant, highlighting the crushing social labor many undiagnosed women perform.
For our science fiction fans, three novels stood out. First, Claire North's Slow Gods.
This was praised for its conceptual weight and immense scope, earning high praise for having the range and pluck to be compared favorably to the late, great I.N.M. Banks.
Then Grace Chan's Every Version of You, a fresh take on humanity diving into an all-digital future.
And finally, Beasts of the Sea by Aida Turpainen, a novel centered around science, environmental destruction, and the extinct Stellar Sea Cow.
We also caught up on the reader letters, which connects some fascinating concepts. One addressed the evolutionary puzzle of survival of the nicest.
The writer argued that altruism makes perfect evolutionary sense, not through individual benefit, but through competition between tribes. The tribe whose individuals work most cooperatively has a higher chance of prospering.
So individuals carrying altruistic genes thrive indirectly through tribal success.
Exactly. Another thread debated human exceptionalism. Are we just arrogant apes? The counterargument was that humans are unique in holding people morally accountable.
Suggesting morality is not just a biological instinct, but a unique cognitive framework for understanding and judging those instincts.
Right. And finally, a highly practical piece of wisdom. When to give up. This applies Charnov's marginal value theorem, originally about an animal exploiting a patch of resources to human endeavor.
And the theorem provides a rational metric for moving on.
It does. The lesson is to maximize your long-term average reward rate. You should quit an unrewarding project when the instantaneous reward rate you are currently getting falls to the point where it equals the long-term average reward rate you could be getting elsewhere.
It's the perfect cold-blooded rational guide for when to pivot. Max, that was an absolutely comprehensive look at the state of science and society. We covered political failure, the reevaluation of reality, radical cell mapping, and even when to quit a project.
We really did span the gamut. And if we synthesize the core threads, we see that despite the political inertia at COP30, scientific progress is accelerating, particularly in understanding foundations. The radical new idea that causality is the fundamental thread of reality.
And that idea that objectivity is merely a relational fact tied to a causal bubble brings us back to our final provocative thought.
Indeed. We learned today that the deepest structure of the universe might be nothing more than a network of causal influences. If the objective reality we perceive is simply a relational fact tied to a causal structure, what does that imply about the human experience of free will?
If every interaction we perceive is governed by a determined structure of causal bubbles, is our subjective feeling of controlling our actions simply another relational fact valid only within our personal causal bubble? We encourage you to explore the tension between the universal causality defines reality and the personal subjective experience of I choose, I cause.
A dense and fascinating tension to mull over. That's all the time we have for this deep dive into the New Scientist issue for November 29th, 2025.
Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep exploring the connections.